Hello, you are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Ben Nelson. It's Thursday, August 1st at 5.03 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Well, as you know, this week is Pride Week in Vancouver, so we have a special Pride-focused show for you today.
CITR's Alex DeBoer took a tour of UBC's special exhibit, A Queer Century, 1869 to 1969, with UBC professors and co-curators Dr. Gregory Mackey and Dr. Kyle Frackman. The exhibit features rare items like postcards, letters, books, and newspapers that comment on gender and sexuality over the decade.
After that, we'll be talking live with local reporter Thomas O'Donnell. Thomas wrote this week's cover story for the UBC, which is the UBC's student newspaper. Their feature delves into the forgotten history of UBC's Pride Collective. But first, we have a short sports headline from our resident sports expert, Ben Nelson.
The Canadian Regional Little League World Series Tournament kicks off today in Ancaster, Ontario. Six teams of tween baseball stars from across Canada will be seeking to win the coveted competition. The champion of the 10-day tournament will win the honor of representing Canada at the International Little League level. The international tournament kicks off in 2 weeks' time in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and will be broadcast on national television. Representing British Columbia in the Canadian Regional Tournament this year, in Ontario, will be Coquitlam Little League. Coquitlam has had seven of their former players drafted into Major League Baseball. If they win this tournament, it will be their first time representing Canada at the Little League World Series. BC has been having a hot streak at the regional tournament. The All-Stars from Surrey's Wally Little League won last year. In fact, a BC team has won the tournament all but 1 year since 2005. Though Canada's most successful years at the international tournament occurred back in 1990 and 1998, when Canadian teams came in third, both years. Both of those teams were also from British Columbia. It'll be exciting to see who will wear the red and white in Pennsylvania this year. No matter who wins, one thing is for sure. These 10 to 12-year-olds have worked extremely hard to even qualify for the regional tournament. Who knows, maybe one day we will see them in the major leagues.
Thanks for the sports update, Ben. So now let's turn to our audio tour of UBC's A Queer Century. Alex got to speak with co-creators of this exhibit, which is happening now through the end of August on the bottom floor of Irving K. Barber Library here at UBC.
All right, yeah, I'm going to get that up. Just opening here on the computer. Here we go. Take a listen.
Hello, sorry.
Okay.
Nice to meet you.
Do you mind if I slurp coffee for 30 seconds?
No, do it.
Wednesday, July 31st, I met with Dr. Kyle Frackman, a professor in the Department of Central, Eastern, and Northern European Studies, as well as Dr. Gregory Mackey from the Department of English Language and Literatures.
So what are we looking at?
We meet in the Rare Books and Special Collections Reading Room, located on the bottom floor of UBC's Irving K. Barber Library. Encircling the room are glass display cases filled with precious items from UBC's archives, colorful pamphlets, yellowing newspapers, letters, postcards, and first editions of classic novels like The Picture of Dorian Gray and Desert of the Heart. This is the site of a new exhibit Kyle and Gregory have co-curated, and it's the reason I'm here to chat with them.
A Queer Century, 1869 to 1969, is our exploration of the history of gender and sexuality in a few different linguistic contexts in English, German, and French. We are using a couple of anniversaries that we have this year in 2019, connecting to the 150th anniversary of the appearance of homosexuality as a named concept in 1869, and the 50th anniversary of the partial decriminalization of homosexuality in Canada and in 1969, and in that same year, the Stonewall uprisings in New York City.
Cool.
So the focus of your exhibit is on, I read in the press release, North America and Europe, or the pieces are all from North America and Europe, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how representative do you feel the exhibit is of, you know, the diversity of queer people on those continents in that century of 1869 to 1969?
I mean, we are somewhat hemmed in terms of our representation by what production there was, right, by what's in the archive. But one of the things the exhibition does is that it goes through a number of different, it's organized in terms of themes. So different themes that explored certain aspects of queer life, experience, and cultural production in that 100-year span before the kind of liberatory turn of 1969. So within those parameters, I think we show quite a wide range of different things. Some of the material we show, for instance, has to do with the law, and with the medical profession, how the medicalization of queer people. We have some historical trans material that I think a lot of listeners will find really illuminating. You know, a lot of this, the discussions around around gender identity are not as recent as some people might think. They've actually been around for a long time. And we have some funny material, too. We have a whole case about camp humor. So there is a surprisingly diverse array of material and, you know, life experience that's on display here at RBSC.
Right. I wanted to ask, 'cause in the press release I read that you highlighted how many of the conversations occurring today are actually not new at all and have been around for centuries. So could we were just talking about that a little bit. Could you elaborate that on a bit? How does this exhibit actually feature a lot of conversations we're having today?
Well, we have a number of materials related to issues of gender and sexuality, trans identities. We have one of the first autobiographies written by a trans or intersex person. We have a case devoted to scandals, the idea of outing public figures related to their sexual expression. And we also have a number of things that show, again, just how these competing ideas of gender and sexuality interwove with each other over the time period that we're looking at, and that there's not just one pure narrative over the course of the time as well. And I think that if people come to the exhibit and look through the materials, they'll see echoes or foreshadowings, I guess, of things that we see today in the present conversation, including, again, these ideas about how people see each other, how people identify themselves, and what kinds of oppression and discrimination some people still might face in contemporary society.
Yeah, one thing too. So a big focus of this exhibit are love letters. There's a few pieces in there. Could you talk about why that's featured? Why love letters are featured?
Well, if we're talking about, you know, about desire and its expression, then, you know, one of the most direct ways of doing that is in terms of love letters. And we're very fortunate to have an extraordinary item, which is a coded postcard that was exchanged between two women in France at the turn of the 20th century. And it's written out in an alphanumerical code because what and we luckily had a graduate student who deciphered the code, and it's in French, so she then translated it into English. And it's a very tender and sentimental expression of affection for between two women. But, of course, this is something that couldn't be expressed as openly then as it could be now. So it was written out, but it was still passed through the mail, so seen by a lot of people publicly, so it was written out in this code. And I think that particular item opens up a whole series of vistas into the way that people express themselves, understood each other, and their relation to the larger society 120 years ago.
Yeah. Cool. You have a number of, there's more than one coded piece in there? Or is that kind of the primary one?
That's the main one, but we do have an entire case devoted to forms of queer communication and expression that aren't necessarily overt. So a lot of the ways in which people communicated were through you know, decades and decades ago, were ways that were sort of protective, so that queer people could understand and communicate with each other without necessarily drawing hostile attention from the larger straight societies. So another example of that would be the Dictionary of Polari, the secret queer language that existed in the UK in the early 20th century. This is one of only two or three in the world that is, survives, and this is from 1937, so we have that, and it's a really fabulous item. We also have a lot of periodicals that were directed towards a queer readership, and one particular one from mid-20th century Germany talks about how to protect yourself from blackmail, because a lot of queer people were very vulnerable to being blackmailed and to being outed, and their whole lives could be destroyed. So this is an instance of a kind of inside the community, people sharing advice about how to protect yourself from the hostile forces of the larger society.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's such a mix of just communication, like love letters, and then like practical advice, like where to go, like we saw in the Naive Guide for the Naive Homosexual, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where to go if you want to go out. Yeah, how to protect yourself. It's interesting. What are your favorite pieces in the exhibit, or one favorite piece? It's probably hard to choose, but...
My favorite piece is a pamphlet written by Karl Heinrich Ulrichs under a pseudonym, written in 1864. So it comes right before the time period of the exhibition that we're looking at. But it was extremely important for setting down in writing an idea of gay identity, what would become gay identity, that was actually extremely foundational for later understandings of sexual orientation. So Ulrichs, in this pamphlet called Vindex, which means defender, he argues that homosexuality is an inborn identity. It's not something that is the result of bad behavior. It's not something that people can be seduced into doing. And this was really the first, or one of the first, texts that actually made this argument based on scientific advances that were happening in the 19th century. And it illustrates that idea, but also shows again that there were, throughout this period, there were various competing perspectives about what caused and what was the result of these kinds of gender and sexual variations, which is, it's very fascinating to look at. And it's extraordinarily rare, and UBC now has one of about 15 copies or so in the world.
I'm sorry, what year was that from?
Published in 1864.
Although part of me wishes that when I was 18, I'd had a guide for the naive homosexual. I guess one of my favorite items is probably the first edition of Oscar Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. I'm an Oscar Wilde scholar, so that's the big connection. But we have a display related to the Oscar Wilde trial, which happened in 1895, which was one of the most sensational sort of sex crimes trials in ever, really. One of the fascinating things about that trial was that literature was used in evidence at the trial as sort of evidence of criminalized behavior. There was a kind of literary reading of his work to indicate that he was queer, and that this should be sanctioned by law, and we're very fortunate here. It's one of the most valuable items we actually have in the library. We have a large paper copy, and it's actually signed by Oscar Wilde.
Wow. Yeah, it's so interesting when literature is taken into court to decide, if a person is gay. Or there was that case. What was it? The Beat poet who wrote that poem, and it was taken into. They had a trial over whether it was like good writing.
Ginsberg. Howl. Yeah. And we were going to show a cop. We have a first edition of Howl, but it's really well known, and it doesn't just display as well. So that's the other challenge about putting together an exhibition like this. You also have to figure out what will be visually arresting and engaging for viewers. But yeah, exactly. There is a long tradition of literature and the law coming up against each other, both in terms of censorship and prohibition and, you know, understandings of obscenity. And also, you know, The Wild is a classic example of literature being used as evidence of behavior as opposed to somebody's imagination, which is kind of a crazy idea to begin with, but you know, The Wild trial is sort of a locus classicus of that phenomenon.
Kyle and Gregory have curated pieces from all over North America and Europe, but I'm interested to know more about Vancouver and Canada specific items, so they take me on a mini tour.
Well, even though our exhibition sort of timeline officially ends with 1969. We also wanted to talk about and display some material related to gay liberation in Vancouver in the early 1970s. And it turns out we have quite a lot of that material at the library, and UBC is an important site for early gay activism. So indeed Vancouver more generally is as well. And one of the reasons, one of the purposes of the exhibition is to correct a sort of Toronto-centric bias sometimes about the history of gay liberation in Canada. And one of the things we discovered in our research is that there was a lot of activism and community building and a lot of publications coming out of Vancouver at that time. So, you know, we have this newspaper called The Gay Canadian, for instance, with a sort of symbolic figure emerging from a closet from 1972. We have some really interesting pamphlets that give advice to local people about what gay liberation is and how to avoid police harassment and discrimination. Also some documentation, some pamphlets and paperwork related to gay people of UBC, one of the founding local campus organizations at that period in time.
Cool. Yeah, is gay people of UBC kind of a precursor to the Pride Society?
It is, yeah. And the most recent issue of the UBC, yesterday's issue, July 30th, has a whole fascinating story about that history. So the material that we have here in the exhibition is the very beginning of that that progression.
Cool. With the Gay Canadian, was that a regular publication, or is it a one-time thing?
It was a local publication, a sort of newspaper that that was published in the 1970s, and this is the first issue. So we're sort of showing the beginnings of that form of expression in the early 1970s.
I read a bit about, just a tiny bit in the press release, about the naive homosexual. Do you want to tell me about that piece?
Sure. We have this item called A Guide for the Naive Homosexual. It was self-published by a local Vancouver gay man, an activist. And this was published in 1971. And it's really a complete introduction for men and women who are coming out of the closet and giving them a kind of primer on what they can expect and where they should go and how to meet people and so on. And it has information about locations of bars and where people can connect with other people. And it also then, as I mentioned, tells people the kinds of things that they might be afraid of, the prejudice that they might encounter, how they might react to that, but also that they're not alone. And so it's funny at times. It uses a lot of humor. It's kind of campy and coy in some ways, and it's an entertaining publication, and it's also an artifact of a particular time and place.
And it was for sale. It has a $1 price on it.
Yeah, it was self-published again by this by the guy who wrote it, Rhodey Green, and published. We have the price on the cover, so for the nice price of $1, people could purchase A Guide for the Naive Homosexual.
Didn't he also invite people to his home for tea in the guide?
Yes, that's one of the things that's also listed in the guide. People could come over and talk to him and get advice and so on, and he offered to make them a cup of tea, which was quite charming.
Yeah. And then there's the Gay Tide, Gay Pride Week 73. Do you want to tell me about that?
Well, Vancouver's was one of the first gay prides in celebrations in Canada. There wasn't a parade yet. The parade didn't start until 78, I think. But 73 was the first year there was a sort of gay pride event and festival in Vancouver. And so this this publication commemorates that. And what's interesting particularly about this is that it gives us the real sort of political activist background to that that time and place. It's got raised fists in the title there, so it's clearly showing a level of fierceness that is, you know, I think sometimes a little bit missing, perhaps in some ways, in the more corporate flavor of the pride events today.
Yeah, very interesting. And you mentioned also how part of this exhibit, this section of the exhibit, is kind of addressing how people may think in Canada that our gay liberation movement is totally Toronto-centric. Mm. So could you elaborate on how this kind of challenges that assumption?
Sure. Well, some of these publications in this particular case were associated with a group called GATE, or the Gay Alliance Towards Equality, which was a local Vancouver organization. And we have a publication in another case called the ASK newsletter. And ASK stands for the Association for Social Knowledge, which is a bit of a euphemistic term. But that particular publication predates the more famous Body Politic out of Toronto by quite a few years. So, you know, we're not, you know, throwing any shade at Toronto, but we also, you know, want to correct some perceptions about, you know, what was going on in Vancouver. And I think it's important to realize that there was a narrative about Vancouver that was very much one of, you know, this is the place where you come to be free and reinvent yourself. And, you know, that I think has eroded a lot over the past 15, 20 years, but it was still very much a big thing in the late 60s and early 1970s. And a lot more sort of openness and social experimentation was seen to be possible here compared to other parts of the country.
And that's changed because of just the cost of living and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I moved to Vancouver, I did my undergrad at UBC. And when I was a little queer kid at 18 moving to Vancouver in the early 1990s, it still very much had that reputation, and I highly doubt that it would today. Now it's, you know, impossibly expensive.
And you mentioned the Body Politique. That's the precursor to Extra?
Right. Yeah. We have, of course, quite a few of those in the collection here. But we thought it would, you know, since we're here at UBC, we would do our representation of the Canadian material would focus more on Vancouver material. And we also have a local writer who's emphasized in a case over here.
Cool.
So Jane Rule was a novelist originally from the United States, but made her career in Vancouver and taught in English and creative writing at UBC for many years, and then moved to Galliano Island, where she continued to write books and publish. She was also an activist, and UBC also has her papers, her archives. So we've got a first edition of her very well-known, her most famous novel, The Desert of the Heart, which is a really affirming lesbian love story. And the first page of the manuscript where she actually has changed the title. So you can see her original title crossed out and the new title that is now known to literary history written out in pencil. And we also have some really interesting letters here too that she received in the 1960s from women all over the world that talk about how reading her novel impacted them and what it meant for them and how it reflected their own lives.
Right. What was the original title?
Permanent Resident was, and I don't know if that's a reference to her immigration status at one point or what it means, but that was the original title
of that novel.
Have you read the novel?
Not for years, but yes, I have. But please don't quiz me on it, even though I'm an English professor.
I haven't read it, but I want to now. How about you? Have you read any of her work?
No, I haven't. I'm familiar with Jane Rohl, but I have not read The Desert of the Heart. But what is so fascinating about the collection that we have here at UBC's Rare Books and Special Collections, as Greg mentioned, these really moving letters from people who did read The Desert of the Heart, who were familiar with Jane Rohl's work, and they wrote to her and let her know how important this was. And so we have some examples of that where people are saying this is extremely important for their own personal journey, and reacting very positively to it. So it's another one of these artifacts that connect to something that was happening relatively locally here for Vancouver, but also to the broader movement that was going on in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and I mean, Desert of the Heart, as it says here, was published in 1964. Like, how rare was a lesbian love story being published in that time, in the 60s and 70s?
It was infrequent, and most of the time when homoerotic material came up in literature and film, it had to be in some kind of coded form. And this was one of the things that set Jane Rohl apart and books like this, because it started to make this push it out into the open a little bit more. And a lot of the literature coming out in the 60s then contributed also to some of the political organizing and agitating that were happening, especially later in the decade.
Do you know if she faced backlash for her work?
I don't know.
Well, things that people got to remember is that the things that she's describing in her novel that was published in 1964 were actually illegal. So, people's desires and their own very personhood was criminalized at that time. And she did have a very hard time publishing it. She was rejected by 22 publishers before she finally did get a publisher. And the novel had a fairly, tepid to positive critical reception at the time. But, you can sort of see the structural forces arrayed against her in the in the rejection notices and the difficulty she had actually getting published and having the courage to write openly about these things. It's interesting that this novel was often compared to Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness, which came out in 1928 and was the subject of an obscenity trial in the UK and a very famous lesbian novel. But there's a lot of years between 1928 and 1964. So that just gives you a sense of how infrequent at the time, discussions of female homosexuality in literature were.
I'm wondering, is it sort of exactly the same for men? Or was it even harder for women? Or just curious.
One of the things we found in our curation of this exhibit is that representation of men is more common. I mean, and I think that probably is a function of patriarchy, whether you're talking about queer or straight men. So I think it's important to. For us to have this material representing the female experience as well.
Putting together the exhibition, the process of curating was delightful, but also somewhat agonizing, because we were limited very practically by the space that we had in the display cases. And what we hope that people will see when they come in and check out the exhibition is that we do have these fabulous materials, but also that they're the tip of the iceberg in terms of what is available in the collection that we have here at UBC in Rare Books and Special Collections. It's a strength that we have here in the collection here, and it points to the importance of the library also for keeping and maintaining a lot of these materials and making sure that people can continue to have access to them. And it's open to the public. These are the kinds of things that people can come in and see. They're welcome to see if they put their stuff away in a locker here at Rare Books and Special Collections, but you're welcome to view these kinds of materials. And it's a very special thing to have them at a public institution like UBC.
Absolutely. So if people want to come see the exhibit, they can come to Irving K. Barber for what are the days it's running?
The exhibition is open until the end of August, and people can come and see it when the Rare Books and Special Collections branches open. That's Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Amazing. Thank you both. Is there anything you wanted to add? Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be back with more local news and Pride history after this short break. All I want to get is
a little bit closer. The 16th annual Vancouver Dyke March and Festival is this Saturday, August 3rd. Gather for the march at 11 a.m. at McSpadden Park, just off Commercial Drive. The march begins at noon and ends at Grandview Park, where the festival will be held from 1 to 5 p.m. Come march against sexual and gender depression, especially where it intersects. This free, family-friendly festival aims to recharge attendees through inclusive celebration.
Did the 1969 Stonewall riots mark the beginning of queer liberation? This is Glenta Koch, creator of the Really Gay History Tour, and I'm standing at the corner of Granville and Robson, not far from the site of the old Castle Hotel. Now, a lot of people know about the Stonewall riots in New York City as the beginning of gay liberation, but this was a wave that had been swelling up for decades. Stonewall was just one of many defining moments in the history of queer liberation. It was a movement that depended on years of local activism. Here in Vancouver, meetings and demonstrations had been going on for decades. And we had our own Stonewall moment in 1971 at the Castle Hotel. Instead of a riot, it was a kiss-in. An outpouring of queer love filled the bar at the Castle Hotel as more than 20 queer couples began to smooch. The police were called, but they were powerless to stop it. These kisses sparked a revolution, and we visit the site of that historic kiss-in on the Really Gay History Tour every Sunday afternoon at 2 and every day of the week during Pride. You can find out more at forbiddenvancouver.ca. Kiss. Sweet, sweet.
MRG Concerts presents Detroit indie rocker Steph Chura will be performing at the Biltmore Cabaret on August 1st with Vancouver's own Dadweed. Don't miss this show and grab your tickets at eventbrite.com or Red Cat Records.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
And we're back. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. It's Pride Week in Vancouver, and we spent the first half of the show taking an audio tour of UBC's A Queer Century exhibit. Again, if you're interested in checking out that exhibit featuring rare items like letters, books, and newspapers all about gender and sexuality, drop into UBC's Irving K. Barber Library any weekday between 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Yes, indeed. When I went to that exhibit this week, I did a tour with the co-curators. As you'll know if you heard the first half of our show, those include Professor Kyle Frackman and Professor Gregory Mackey. And one of the items they showed me in one of the cases of rare collections included was a pamphlet for, it said Gay UBC on it. I asked about that, and they said it was a pamphlet for one of the first iterations of what we call today the UBC Pride Collective,
Collective. So I found that really interesting because I didn't know a lot of the history of that collective. And Gregory, one of the professors, also mentioned to me that, you know, if I wanted to learn more, the cover story of the UBC this week was all about that. So I reached out to the author of this feature, Thomas O'Donnell, who's in studio with us now, to ask a bit about their reporting and the reporting process and what they found. So welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So the feature you wrote is titled The People I've Been Missing All My Life. Subtitle, The Forbidden History of the Pride Collective. Mm-hmm. So maybe do you want to just start out by giving us a brief summary of the article?
So I guess if we're talking about structure, it starts with a little bit of the history of the Pride Collective, starting in the very beginning, and then sort of like working its way through like how the title of the Pride Collective has changed, sort of like how it's changed from just like an AMS club to a service organization to now it's a resource group. It also sort of talks about like how kind of like the activism and advocacy of the club has changed. And then it sort of moves into, the article moves into like what it sort of meant to people from like the 70s and onward, and then sort of it briefly touches on like issues that people who were in the collective had within campus, and then it sort of ends on a little wholesome note of, does it get better out there?
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah, so you mentioned the name, and it was very interesting in the article how it evolved over time. You're right about how it was originated in a group called the Gay Liberation Front in 1971. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about how and why the name of this group changed to what we know today as the Pride Collective?
Yeah. So it's, I guess, I don't want to say it's really interesting because the whole thing is really interesting, but it has, I mean, pretty obviously moved from being not an exclusionary name, but often people who aren't gay men don't necessarily connect with the term gay. So it's moved through quite a few names. It obviously started with, I have to read my own article, the Gay Liberation Front, and then it moved to, like, Gay People of UBC, and then they just kept adding titles, so it became, like, Gays and Lesbians of UBC, and then Gays, Lesbians, and Bisexuals of UBC, and then in the 90s, they were having a discussion whether or not to, like, add, like trans to the title of the club, and instead of making it longer, they just sort of went with a more like umbrella term of Pride UBC, and now the title is the AMS Pride Collective.
So it's really interesting. You talked a lot about more inclusivity. The other thing I think we noticed with the name is you mentioned that they try to make the name more mainstream, less threatening as well, like Gay Liberation Front.
Yeah.
Maybe has some connotations of more militancy. Yeah. So do you also see that reflected in the choice of how they changed the name over time?
Yeah, I think it was like a really important thing in like the very early days, sort of. I can't speak to it too much, but like it seems that the original members were like very into the liberation movement in Vancouver. A lot of the early members were part of Gate Vancouver, which was like a gay liberation sort of movement. And then I think some other members within the club sort of more wanted that like community aspect and community building. I know that sort of like discussion of like activism versus community is, I think, like a discussion that is always happening in the queer community. And I know someone who I interviewed who was in the club in 1985 was talking about how there was like almost two clubs within a club, like people who were really like radical activists and people who were sort of more like, I just want to like hang out and chill and meet people. I don't necessarily feel comfortable, or I don't necessarily like want to, you know, be smashing stuff. So I think it's really about like what an individual wants from the organization or club. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Another thing, like these changes in names and also the imagery. Mm. I think there was an image of a fist early on. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is a step in the larger corporatization of Pride? or not?
That's a really good question. I think, oh, wow, it's so hard that I'm on the other end of having to answer, like,
yeah,
hard,
you've been, like, asking all,
like,
the questions.
Yeah, like thinking questions.
Right.
I don't necessarily know if it's, like, part of the corporatization of pride, but I think, yeah, I think, I don't want to say yeah anymore, like, to sort of gain sometimes to gain more, like, wide-reaching respect and tolerance and acceptance, I think often queer groups and movements sort of have to soften their image. But I think, like, I don't want to put it all on that for the club, right? Mm-hmm. I think, like, it also has to do with, yeah, like, what individuals and, like, group members, like, wanted from the club.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the difficulty in doing this kind of reporting, this kind of historical reporting on groups like the Pride Collective, mm-hmm. is that in queer groups, early queer groups, they often wanted to, people often wanted to maintain anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
And you pointed that out in your reporting. So could you talk a bit about why that was the case and how you kind of dealt with that in your reporting when a lot of your sources would have been anonymous?
Yeah. I guess I think there's, like, two parts to that question. I think the first part is, like, how difficult it is to learn a lot about early queer history.
Mm-hmm.
And something that sort of had to be, I could have included that a lot more in the piece, as I talked to Ron Dutton, who is, like, the founder of the BC Gay and Lesbian Archives. And he had some really excellent quotes that just talk about, like, how queer history, or history always is history mm-hmm. is determined by the dominant group.
Yeah.
So obviously lots is left out, like most things ever are left out of history. So because like queer people are a marginalized group, they have always been left out of history. So a lot of the, like, archival information, like posters and pamphlets, just get not necessarily, like, thrown away, but they're not particularly, like, no one thought that they were important enough to keep. And something else he touched on was, like, a lot of archive work can kind of come from, like, individuals having things.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times in queer history, let's say an individual has a pamphlet, they might not want to keep it because they're nervous about someone else going through their stuff.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, they don't necessarily, like, want to, yeah, they don't want someone else to find it, or, like, they, not that they don't think it's important, but, like, that. And then something else he touched on that was really interesting was, I don't want to, like, paraphrase him too much, but mm-hmm. sort of, like, how, like, when you're living through a thing, you don't necessarily think that it's important,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's another reason, like, why individuals don't necessarily, like, you know, like, I don't keep every pamphlet I've ever seen. Like, I don't keep every I don't tear down every poster I've ever seen, right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
And I don't want to say, like, it's on the individual to archive things well, but that was something that was really interesting. And then how'd that affect my reporting? It affected my reporting in that, like, finding the early history was incredibly difficult. At the UBC, we're incredibly lucky because our 100 years of issues have been archived by the university itself.
Nice.
So a lot of it was using like very specific search terms that I had found by myself and through the help of Sheldon Goldfarb with the AMS. Like, using those search terms to, like, specifically try to find, like, people who had written letters into the UBC.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the problem is, like, only people who were, like, at the UBC, it used to be you had to sign, or it still is, you have to, like, it has to be under your name. You can't have anonymous letters.
Right.
And in the 1970s, it's such an understatement to say not a lot of people were queer, but not a lot of people were, like, out as queer. So it was very difficult to find people who wanted to sign their name to letters and, like, sign their name to letters that would be published for, like, all of campus to read. Those could get out to anywhere, right? Like, that could affect your, like, job prospects and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were the people who, the letters that ran in the UBC, were they, like, what were, was a common letter that would have referenced the Pride Collective or whatever iteration of the club was then? Like, would it have been promoting the club or how? Yeah.
Well, the letters, I think the earliest letters probably go back to 1972. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was, a lot of them were actually, like, members of the club reacting to things happening on campus. Like, there was in, I don't want to say a thing. There was a thing that happened in 1972 where a liberal MP came to campus, and two members of the club questioned him on whether or not the Liberal Party was going to take a stance on lowering the age of consent on homosexual sex.
Okay.
And he said, because it was when it was partially decriminalized in 1969, the age limit of consensual sex was 21 for homosexuals, whereas I believe it was 18. If I'm wrong, then this is really embarrassing. But yeah, so the members of the club like questioned him on that, and he was like, "That's not something we're going to take a stand on at all in the upcoming election." So a lot of, or a few letters were written about that, but most, a lot of the letters were written in probably about the, I don't want to say like in the like mid to late 80s, which was really interesting because I feel like a lot of our, this sounds so silly, but I don't. Like, I think when we look back, we always think of, like, the hard queer times as, like, the 60s and 70s. So I was sort of a bit taken aback by the, like, how much conflict there was even in the 80s, which I think is incredibly naive of me to not think that that's how it was. But, like, there were quite a few issues with the dances and, like, harassment of club members from members of fraternities. Mm-hmm. So really often people would write letters being like, me and my friend were harassed. And then there would sort of be, like, because it wasn't Facebook, there would be, like, a discourse. And then, like, the next week a frat member would write a letter. And then the next week after that, someone from the club would write another letter. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I just, like, find it shocking, and again, that's really naive of me, that like there's a different age for consent.
Yeah,
not even shocking, it's just like illogical.
Yeah
it's because it's like I know that it was illegal,
yeah,
and it was partially decriminalized in 1969, mm-hmm. but that there was a different age limit, like that just is like random.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, but what?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you can do it, but you have to wait like 3 years longer.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of dealing with that new piece of knowledge. Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm. So where am I in my... did you have a question, Armand?
Yeah. So you write in the piece, while times have changed, the organization's mandate has not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is the mandate of the organization? And how do you think it has managed to stay relevant as both the club and society has evolved?
Oh, I don't necessarily know that I can speak to that too much. Mm-hmm. I don't want to like cop out and be like, I can't answer your question. But because I focused so much of my research on the old club, I don't know very much about the like current club. I think probably the biggest thing that I can think of like off the top of my head is just how it's like just how it has changed from being it has changed to being a resource group, right?
Right.
So I think I once again, I don't want to speak for it, but I imagine that that can kind of limit the sort of like stances you can take on issues.
What is a resource group? Can you?
A resource group. Ooh, I think the best definition I know of, it's like. A resource group is sort of something that, like, is more under, not, like, the power, but, like, it's more under the AMS than a regular club because it takes, not, like, fees, but, like, it takes part of your AMS fees.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think you can opt out of them. Yeah. And they got official club rooms. I don't know that.
Okay. Well, but essentially they have some sort of status that they are can take less. They're more tied to the AMS, which is the Alma Student Society. For those who don't know, like the student body that governs like clubs and societies at UBC. So they're more bound by the AMS than they have been in the past. Is that more or less?
Yeah. I think so. Once again, I don't want to like speak too strongly on that because I'm not, I should have looked up what the definition of a resource group is. But yeah, I would imagine that it sort of like changes the capacity to which you can operate somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't really know how that is, so I'm so sorry.
No, that's, but their mandate remains roughly what, like?
Ooh, I don't even know if I can answer that. I think their mandate is sort of like pushing the importance of like representation and really being like a very safe space for students, especially. I think the Pride Collective has had to do quite a bit of the safe spaceness, considering the recent issues that UBC has had. Let's use a nice word to describe it.
Do you want to tell our listeners what you might be referencing?
I don't want to get too political. The university <It's okay. laughs> the university has sort of had some issues with hosting spaces for transphobic speakers, which has now had consequences for them, as they were kicked out of the, or I don't, they were removed from the Vancouver Pride Parade. And I know that the Pride Collective and the AMS and like the Faculty Association were all strong advocates against that space being given to the transphobic speakers.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. That's big news.
Yeah.
Right. So you spoke. You spoke about a lot of former members. You spoke to, I'm sorry, a lot of former members of the group when you're putting this piece together. So I think you said you did 11 interviews.
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't think there are 11. Voices in here, like, or were there any, so like the people spoke about the club as being both a space, or the organization as being both a space, like you mentioned, to like hang out and make friends and just like be safe. And then also a place to be more radical and fight for equal rights. So were there any interviews you did, any stories you heard that didn't make it in that, where people told you about their experiences with the Pride Collective and what it meant to them that you wanted to share?
Oh my God. I could talk about this for probably 4.5 hours. I had, sadly, because of the limit of space and also because I can't just publish the transcript of 11 interviews.
Sadly.
So much had to be not cut, but so much had to be not put into the article. I would say every single phone interview I did, I cried. Oh. One of the in-person interviews I did, I cried. Just the interviews were so incredibly amazing. Like, people told me such incredibly moving stories. Oh. People told me such incredibly difficult stories. What was it? Someone told, like, I heard a lot about, I heard a lot about sort of like the role that the AIDS crisis played in the club, which was obviously quite difficult to hear, but really important to hear. And sadly, none of that could make it into the piece just because of a lack of space. I got to hear about the incredible advocacy that the club did during those times. A lot of what didn't make it in, which is also really sad, was like sort of like more specific incidents of discrimination that club members felt. There were a lot more anecdotes. Never necessarily like actual conflicts, but there were a lot of issues. I touched on it briefly, but a lot of issues with members of fraternities and members or people who were engineering students.
Yeah.
Yeah. And almost always it was more described as like, never any actual problems, but just quite a lot of homophobic air which is very interesting. And no one really ever went into, like, what does that mean? What is a homophobic air? But it was sort of just like that, the more general. I wish I could have included it more, but everyone had incredible things to say about the club. For every quote that I have about what it meant to people, I have like 5,000 more quotes about just how truly important this space mm-hmm. was to them, and how like incredibly important it was in their like becoming who they were as people mm-hmm. and sort of like becoming who they wanted to be and like learning from each other. Stuff like that. For every quote that I have about It Gets Better, I have like 5,000 more like incredible quotes where like every time I went to transcribe, I would just be like completely bawling, like typing through my tears. Wow. There was just like so much amazing things. What I didn't expect was, I guess, like how not necessarily like how optimistic the people were, but I think like how, I don't know if I expected them to be like so uplifting, like they'd sort of be like, yeah, we fought the fight, but that fight is never done, like there are still like people who were our age who are like discriminated against, there are people who were our age who like don't feel safe, and like a lot of them were like they really, not necessarily like, I don't know if regretted is the right word, but they really regretted that like they didn't work as hard to make space for like other groups. Like a lot of people were like, I don't want to say felt bad, but they were like, there just wasn't that language around trans people at the time, and they were like, that feels bad, like that we got to feel good and we got to have a safe space, and even though we were never trying to not have other people there, like we could have worked harder to make it a safe space for everyone, which was very, I think once again uplifting, in like that they weren't just like sitting back being like sort of like the we didn't start the fire kind of like baby boomers thing. They were like, there was always more to do.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to look at, you know, look back and think, oh, did we not do enough? Mm-hmm. I found it really interesting in your article. We're just almost out of time here, but that the you mentioned, of course, the engineers mm-hmm. and the frats were sort of like the two groups were most antagonizing of the queer community, which is, I don't know. Yeah, it's just somehow those places, well, especially the frats, it makes sense. But there are obviously places where toxic masculinity tends to occur more than in other places perhaps, but that now the engineering department is the only department with their own like pride society.
Yeah,
so that's pretty cool.
It was, yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, that was nice. So it's 6 o'clock, so our show is gonna have to come to a close. But Thomas, thank you so much for coming in and for your article. And for those who haven't read it yet, you can pick it up in physical tangible copy around UBC, the UBC campus. Mm. It's the cover story. And it'll be online soon. It's not at the moment.
Yes, yeah. It's also, all of our print issues are online, like in their print form.
Yeah, the PDF version.
Yes. issue.com/UBC, I think.
Yeah, so you can find it on there too. So check it out if you haven't read it already. Thank you to all our listeners for listening. This has been another episode of Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly local news program. Please tune in again next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more local news. Subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office, if you haven't already. Thanks for listening and have an awesome weekend. Bye-bye.